so excited to welcome you to Real Woman, Real Torah, a project of Bacheva Learning Center. We're here to offer you an authentic Torah learning experience, produced for woman, by woman. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Demystifying Hilchos Nida, a podcast series with Mrs. Rivki Kaplan, in which we'll explore the historical background and underlying halachic principles behind the laws of Nida. Mrs. Kaplan is a shlucha, teacher, lecturer, and yuetzet halacha with over 20 years of experience teaching and mentoring women in the area of Taharas HaMashpacha. She will be building on her experience and expertise in Hilchos Nida to give us a deeper appreciation for the halachas that we practice every single day. Please keep in mind while listening that this series is intended for educational purposes only and should not replace seeking qualified rabbinic guidance for any application to practical halachic scenarios. Our goal for this series is to enhance your observance of Taharas HaMashpacha and to inspire you to observe the halachas in the most optimal way. Please note that each individual episode is only one part of a bigger picture, so we encourage you to listen to all the episodes in the series in order to get a complete understanding of the content we discuss here. This episode is sponsored by Marissa Lewitin in memory of her mother, Pnina Yalta Leah Bas Yosef Yitzchak. May her neshama have an aliyah. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the second episode in our series with Mrs. Rivki Kaplan on Hilchos Nida. And in this episode, we're going to be exploring the original source in the Torah for the concept of Nida d'Oraisa. We're going to be exploring the concepts of Nida and Zava and how those ultimately play a role in understanding the way we practice Hilchos Nida today.
Okay, so thanks, Adasa. So we're going to get started. And as mentioned, in order to understand Nida d'Oraita, of course, the first place we're going to look is in the Chumash, right? So the first reference that we have to the notion of Nida, well, I should really correct myself. Because the very, very first reference that we have to the notion of Nida, I was going to quote Vayikra, but the very first reference really shows up much, much earlier in Bereshit, when following the sin of Chet Etz Hadat, right? And one of the punishments, one of the consequences that Chava receives is the notion of Nida, which is a fascinating discussion, which we won't go into today, but I just want to put it out there that the first time we meet Nida is not in Vayikra, but actually in Bereshit. But we are going to go into Vayikra today, and on Parshat Metzora, and there's two psukim, or three psukim, really, that we're going to be expanding on. And ultimately, what's going to emerge, I hope, from this episode is a better understanding of Nida d'Oraita, i.e. Nida, how it was kept during the times prior to the change being made. Okay, now why do I say that? And why does that sound confusing? So everything that we do today in keeping the laws of Nida, or as it's more popularly known, the laws of Taharat HaMashpacha, you'll notice as we talk, are going to be very different to what we see in the psukim. And we're going to have a separate episode, which is going to emphasize, you know, the when and how things change. So what we're going to be meeting today is really the original manner in which the women for generations, i.e. until the change, kept Nida, as it was known, Nida d'Oraita, okay? So the first pasuk that we meet is in, like I mentioned, in Parshat Metzora. And I do want to read this pasuk inside because it's important for us to hear the words, because they're going to teach us some very important, they're going to teach us a very important criteria, okay? So the pasuk tells us, V'isha ki tiye zava, when a woman has a discharge or when a woman has a flow, dam yiye zava bibsara, her discharge, her flow from her flesh, okay, being blood. Shivat yamim tiye benidata, for 7 days she remains in her state of nida. V'chal hanogea ba yitma ad ha'erev, and anybody who touches her is also becomes impure until evening, okay? So this is our first introduction to a woman becoming a nida. And the pasuk tells us, like we saw, when a woman has a flow, the flow being that of blood, okay, discharging from her bibsara, from her body, She remains in a state of nida for 7 days, and anyone that touches her remains impure until evening. Okay. Now, some of that might be sounding familiar because you're hearing the notion of flow, you're hearing the notion of blood, you're hearing the idea of 7 days. But we need to clarify, what does the pasuk actually mean over here? So in this pasuk, we're given the 3-point criteria to what is nida d'oraita. And you're going to hear me reference this over and over again. So get comfortable. So the first point, the first criteria, in order for a woman to be nida d'oraita, the pasuk tells us, we learn from the word zava. And the Gemara asks, wait a second, discharge from anywhere in her body, that makes her a nida? And the Gemara, of course, then goes on to explain, no, it particularly needs to be a discharge from her rechem, from her womb, okay? So that's criteria number one. The second criteria the pasuk teaches us, we learn from the word dam. So then you could say, wait, any kind of discharge from the womb? And the Gemara says, no, it has to be dam. And back in the day, prior to the change, it was actually blood of 5 different shades of red. There was a precise art or science to understanding which blood was problematic. And there was 5 particular shades. And only if she had a discharge from her rechem, criteria number one, that fit, okay, the exact requirement of which shade of red, of indicating that it was blood, okay, that would be criteria number two. And the third criteria is indicated in the pasuk from the word bibsara, from her flesh, which tells us that it had to be accompanied by some kind of physical sensation, which is primarily known in halachic terminology as a hargasha. Again, something that we'll address in a further episode, okay? So now this pasuk has imparted with us the 3-point criteria in order for a woman to be nida d'oraita. Number one, it has to be from her rechem, it has to be from her womb. It can't be from her vaginal canal or from any other part of her body. Number two, it has to be blood. And number three, it needs to be accompanied by hargasha, by some kind of physical sensation. Again, from those words of zava, from the words of dam, and from the word of bibsara. Each one of these words fleshed out by the commentaries, primarily from the Gemara, okay, from the Mishnah and the Gemara. So that's the first pasuk that we meet. And then what happens? So if a woman has a flow from her rechem, and it is blood, and it is accompanied by hargasha, what happens? From the moment that she experiences this, for 7 days, she remains in her state of nida. Now, we have to pay close attention to this, because I'm using the word 7, but I'm not using the word 7 clean days. That's only going to show up in a few minutes. So right now, what we're saying is, say a woman, it's Sunday morning, it's the first of the month of Adar, and she notices that she's had a flow from her rechem accompanied by a hargasha. For 7 days, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbos, okay, she remains in her state of nida. Whether her blood continues to flow or whether her blood does not continue to flow, irregardless of that. So from the moment she starts her nida, I don't want to say period, but I guess I'll use that term. So from the moment she starts her nida count, okay, that's a better choice of words, I guess, she remains in her state of nida for 7 days, okay? Then, towards shkia of the 7th day, she performs a hefsek tara, right? Something that we're familiar with, to clarify that her bleeding has actually, to ascertain that her bleeding has actually stopped, right? The hefsek tara would involve an internal exam. Once she's ascertained that her bleeding has actually stopped, later that very same day, after tzetek ochavim, after the stars come out, she immerses in the mikvah and she is tahar. Okay? So we have 7 days she remains in her state of nida. Whether she continues to bleed for all those 7 days or whether she only bleeds for 1 or 2 days or even just 1 day, okay? Prior to shkia of the 7th day, she ascertains that her bleeding has stopped by performing an internal exam. Once the sun has set, and we've had Seta Kochavim, of that very same day, she immerses in the mikvah, right? So our woman who has had her Nida period start on that Sunday, right? So again, we have Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbat before Shkia, she performs her Hafsek Tara. Even if she had been bleeding, right? You know, Shabbat morning or Shabbat in the afternoon, doesn't matter. So long as she was able to have a clean Hafsek Tara before Shkia, she would immerse that very day after Tzata Kochavim, so I guess after Havdalah, right? And she would become Tahar at that point. Now, I just want to kind of add parenthetically that the Gemara, again, elaborating on a Mishnah, has a lengthy discussion as to how early can a woman actually perform her Hafsek Tara? Is it required that it is done as close to Shkia of the seventh day? Or would it be considered also to be a valid Hafsek Tara if it was done earlier that day or even earlier in that week, okay? And there's a lot of back and forth. And the bottom line is that ideally, the Gemara rules, it should be done as close to Shkia of the seventh day. But there's definitely room that if a woman were to do it earlier, it would still be considered to be a valid Hafsek Tara. Now, why am I throwing that in? Because it's upon this episode that many of our conversations are going to be held, right? So let's fast forward to 2022, when a woman is required to perform a Hafsek Tara quite differently, right, than how she performed it back in the day. But nevertheless, still the same halachic Hafsek Tara, right? Now, generally speaking, we know that we do our Hafsek Tara towards Shkia of the fifth day of when we had our flow, right? But it could happen sometimes that a woman would have done it earlier in the day. Or, for example, she has to repeat her Hafsek Tara, and so the bdika that she did on one of her seven clean days now becomes retroactively her Hafsek Tara, even though it had been done in the morning, right? So some of you might be more familiar with what I'm referencing. To some of you, this might be new stuff, but don't worry about it. In the following episodes, I'm going to elaborate on each one of these details. But as I reference things that were Nida d'oraita, and they have ramifications in the way we keep Nida today, I like to try to connect the dots for us, at least in a somewhat summarized manner. Okay. So that's our Nida d'oraita for now. So a woman, 7 days, she remains in her state of Nida, Hafsek Tara, immerses in the mikvah after Tzata Kochavim. Okay, now, I want to just take a moment to talk about those last few words of the Psukim, where it talks about how a woman, when she's in her state of Nida, anything she touches or anybody that she touches, okay, becomes impure until evening. Now, obviously, that's not something that has practical application today. But I want to point out that, you know, during the times of the Beit HaMikdash, as referenced in our earlier episode, Tumah and Tahara really ruled the day. And when a woman was in Nida, in contrast to today, when it's something that's kept very private, and very kind of low-key, intentionally so, and correctly so, back in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, if a woman was a Nida, the Gemara even talks about how she wore particular Nida clothing so as to allow people to know that I am in a state of Nida and you actually don't want to touch me. Because if you touched me, then you'll become impure until evening. Now, I often get asked the questions, well, how did that actually work practically, you know? And from the research that I've done and from the questions that I've asked, my understanding of how this was done practically was households back in the day consisted of more than one woman. What I mean by that is that the nuclear family was much larger, right? And so there was a number of generations really living under one roof. And so there were a number of women to the household. So when a woman was in a state of Nida, she really would not seclude herself because there's a taboo associated with being a Nida, but for practical reasons, you know, it wouldn't be very helpful to have her in the household, you know, touching things. And particularly, again, as referenced in last week's episode, if a woman belonged to a Kohanic household, right? Her husband was a Kohen or her father was a Kohen, etc. Then when she was in a state of Nida, she was certainly, she was certainly not permitted to touch any of the gifts, any of the kachin, that the holy gifts that her husband or father would bring home from the Beit HaMikdash. Because not only do those need to be eaten in a state of tahara, in a state of purity, but even if you were touching them and you were in a state of nida or any other state of impurity for that matter, then you would invalidate, you would impurify, and the gifts would have to be destroyed and discarded, right? So this was something that women were very keenly aware of. And because the ramifications of it were not just exclusive to the area of intimacy, there was no, so to speak, secrecy or privacy associated with it. It was just like, you know, a kind of like state of affairs. Like when someone has corona, I'm going to let people know that I have corona because I might be contagious. And if then you get it, you're not going to be able to fly, or you're not going to be able to socialize, and you're not going to be able to go to work, etc. So there's no shame in the matter. It's just a matter of fact. I need to let you know that right now I am carrying a contagious disease, so to speak, right?
That's and so fascinating.
The parallel to Tumah and Tahara, right? Isn't it fascinating that when Corona hit the world, I was like, not knee deep, I was kind of like neck deep, you know, in studying these laws. And the parallel was like uncanny because it really gave us an understanding. I mean, I know, especially here in Israel, there was sort of like first degree, second degree, third degree, right? If you were in the room with the person and you touched them, or if you were in the room, you were not in the room with the person, etc., would depend on how much it affected you and how much of a consequence it had in your own life, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's just such a good analogy, I think, for halacha in general and like people's, you know, stringencies with halacha. You know, I think, you know, when COVID first hit, it was around Pesach time and people have all kinds of stringencies associated with Pesach and chametz. And some people, I feel like, okay, why are you going so crazy? You know, like stop being so neurotic. And those would be the same people who might be neurotic about other, you know, about like illness and coronavirus and things like that. And, you know, I just feel like it's such a good analogy for like when you see something as an objective reality, right? Like Tumah and Tahara was a real part of people's lives. It was like, and it had real repercussions, right?
Exactly.
So like when you see it that way, it's just like, yeah, of course, I'm going to take whatever precautions I can to like make sure that this isn't gonna spread. I think also it's so fascinating that you were saying that I think today something a lot of women struggle with is feeling like Nida is associated with shame, or, you know, part of it is when it's private or secret, you can sort of get that conception that there's sort of this shameful or almost like a negative association with that status. And I think back in the day when it was something that was so factual and just sort of like a regular part of normative part of people's lives, they didn't necessarily have that association.
Exactly. And it's, I think it's important for us to move away from that, you know. And then you have books, you know, like The Red Tent or something like that, that do a great disservice, you know, to that notion as well, or I should say a great service to that notion as well, whereas women were considered like almost taboo, you know, or dirty or untouchable, right? Now, all those things are in a way, the notion of untouchable, it's true in a certain context, meaning like untouchable, certainly by her husband, and also by other members of her family, unless, of course, they wanted to be in a state of Tumah, you know, Ada Erev as well. And I remember one time listening to a great shiur, I think it was by Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, where he was describing, you know, back in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, how, you know, you would meet somebody going to the mikvah, and they were literally bringing their entire household with them. Okay? Because there were many strains of Tumah and Tahara, almost as many or more than the many strains of COVID that we've become familiar with. Right. And again, depending on who and what and the different stages and phases, etc., it was very, very common that people would transmit this impurity and there would be the necessity of purifying something. Right. And again, as mentioned in last week's episode, once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, right, once we lived through that horrible, devastating tragedy, amongst the many things that we lost was this reality of Tumah and Tahara. This idea, this ideal of living our lives in a perfectly aligned manner so that we were always striving to be in a state of Tahara. And the primary or perhaps the exclusive gatekeepers to the notion of Tahara d'Oraita became the Jewish woman. So it's really something, you know, it's almost like it's really a gift that we have access to. And there's certainly, certainly no shame in the matter.
So Rifki, can you just explain, so we've discussed the source in the Torah for the concept of Nida d'Oraita and that bringing Tumah along with it and the process the woman would go through to sort of get to a state of Tara. So where do we get this notion, because there's sort of this additional concept around Nida, different than other areas of Tumah where we also have the concept of separation with her husband. So can you explain where that comes in? Is that connected to the idea of Tumah? Is that a separate idea? Where does that come in?
Okay, excellent. Okay, so let's go back to that, right? So there are two other psukim, two other references in the Torah that talks about that when a woman is in a state of nida, intimacy is forbidden, okay? So when we're talking about particularly the state of tumah that a woman experiences as a result of the nida, there are going to be two areas of her life that are going to be off limits, okay? Area number one is going to be the area of intimacy. Now, obviously, that is going to affect only a woman that's in an intimate relationship, okay, i.e. marriage. And the area of anything associated with the Beit HaMikdash, okay? So back in the day, when Nida affected everybody, okay, you could have a 12-year-old girl who gets her period for the first time, enters a state of Nida, and she belongs to a Kohanic family. So there's going to be a lot of ramifications to her being in a state of Nida. And she's not going to be permitted to, you know, help out with sorting or pickling or cooking or whatever it was that they did with the various food gifts that her father would have brought home from his shift in the Beit HaMikdash, okay? Now, once she would enter a marriage and would be involved in an intimate relationship, okay, there would be an additional prohibition that would forbid the area of intimacy as well. With the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and that whole area of our life, unfortunately, you know, being put on hold, the only remaining area that is going to be affected by the state of impurity with Nida is going to be the area of intimacy. Okay, so I hope that addresses your question, right? So there's a separate psukim in two different sources that prohibit intimacy with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. That remains the only area of our life that is influenced by our state of Nida, okay? Which is why, kind of organically, it became something that was much more discreet and low-key and private than back in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, because the only ramification of it is with my spouse. And why does the rest of the world need to know? And I would say even more than that, the rest of the world certainly shouldn't know, you know, where I'm holding with what is permitted to me or what is not permitted to us as a couple. So I'm going to treat it just like I should treat all areas of my intimate life, with a sense of privacy, and with a sense of, like, you know, this is ours and not open for discussion, okay? Having said that, I do want to emphasize again that whenever we're talking about the areas of intimacy and Nida and the laws of Tarat Mashpacha, etc., right? Maybe earlier I referenced the word secret, but really what I like to talk about really is the word private, you know? It can be private. It doesn't have to be a secret. A secret often, for many, sort of holds like a negative association. What do I mean by that? Give me a moment here to explain myself. If a woman is struggling, or not even struggling, if a woman is challenged, or if a woman has a question in the area of, in any area of Tahara Mishpacha, from any aspect of it, it's something that should be addressed in a private manner, i.e. she should reach out for guidance to somebody that's going to respect her privacy. She doesn't have to feel like, oh, this is a secret. Nobody's allowed to know about this. I need to suffer with this. I need to struggle with this on my own.
Just to go back to my question. So I guess these two prohibitions are linked in the sense that, you know, the prohibition of her intimacy with her spouse and the tumah that affects her relationship with anything to do with the Beis HaMikdash, they're connected in the sense that her purification from one affects the other, right? So if she whatever purification process is described in the Torah for getting her out of that state of tumah will also allow her to then reunite with her husband, right? Which is why we still have that concept today, of going through that, those same steps of purification in order to allow for the unification of the couple.
Yeah, exactly. Well said, Hadassah. What applied to one, applied to the other. And once the whole notion of the Beit HaMikdash is unfortunately on a pause, the one area that this remains is in the area of intimacy. Okay. But now let's go back into the Psukim. Let's go back into Parshat Metsora, because up until now, we've really only met the Nida. And now what we're going to meet is maybe the lesser known of the two impurities that are associated with a flow, and that is of the Zava. And the Pasuk tells us over here that when a woman has a flow, but here's the kicker. It says when a woman has a flow, but it is not the time of her Nida, okay? She becomes impure like the Nida. And in order for her to become pure, the Pasuk tells us, when her flow stops, she needs to count 7 days. And at that point, she becomes pure, okay? So what's going on over here? What is the Pasuk telling us? She is experiencing a flow. So clearly this flow is coming from her rechem. It's coming from her womb. It is also blood, okay? And yet it is not the time that she is a Nida. And yet she experiences a tuma. And in order for her to become tahar, once the flow stops, she needs to count 7 days, okay? So we've just met the Zava. Now, the Zava, as we can see from the Psukim, is referring to somebody who experiences, I think, what we would call nowadays sort of interperiod bleeding, right? So the Nida, I would put into the category of somebody that's experiencing her menstrual cycle. And the Zava is sort of somebody that's experiencing, sometimes we call it breakthrough bleeding nowadays. But suffice to say, it's kind of like it's an aberration. In other words, she shouldn't really be experiencing bleeding at this point. And yet she is, okay? There's sort of something abnormal, if you will, almost, that's going on over here, okay? And the reason I kind of use the word abnormal is because Chassidus actually uses that term, because we're going to see is that her Tahara process is going to be more strenuous. It's going to be more extensive than the Zava Tahara process is more detailed and longer, okay, than the Nida process, reflecting that she has experienced a more severe exposure to tuma. And that's why we choose the word abnormal, because this is not really something that she should be normally experiencing, and yet she is, okay? And so what was the Tahara process for the Zava? Once her flow stops, okay? Well, let me back up for a moment. Because the halacha teaches us actually that there were two forms of a zava. There is what was known as the zava ktana, and there was what was known as the zava gdaila. So the zava ktana would be somebody that experienced 1 or 2 days of bleeding when she is not a nida. And I'm going to explain that in just a moment. So if she were to experience 1 or 2 days, she would still be considered to be a zava ktana. She would wait one additional day to ensure that she wasn't experiencing a third day of bleeding. And at the conclusion of that day, she would immerse in the mikvah and she was tahar. However, if she would experience 3 consecutive days of bleeding, she would then become a zava gdaila. And at that point, once her flow stops, so it could be her flow stops at the conclusion of the third day. It could be it continues for more days. Once her flow stops, again, ascertained by a hefsek tahara, according to most opinions, she would then count 7 clean days. And only at the conclusion of the 7 clean days, then she would go to the mikvah, okay? So now remember, this is the second time we're talking about the number 7 in our conversation. But in contrast to the Nida, where she was possibly actively still bleeding during those 7 days. In the Zava, it's a very different scenario. She needs to wait until the flow stops, ascertained by the Hefsek Tahara. Then she begins 7 clean days. How does she know if those days are clean? She performs a bdika, okay, an internal exam, during those 7 clean days. And once she's had 7 clean days, at the conclusion of the 7th day, she then immerses in the mikvah, okay? So let's do a parallel over here between the Nida and the Zava. The Nida, from the moment she gets her period, she waits 7 days in her state of Nida. She performs her Hefsek Tahara. That very evening, she immerses in the mikvah. The Zava, if she has 3 consecutive days of bleeding, when she is not a Nida, and again, I still have to explain that, she has 3 consecutive days of bleeding when she is not a Nida. She then ascertains that her bleeding has stopped. And then she has 7 clean days. Only at the conclusion, at those 7 clean days, then she immerses in the mikvah. So a woman would be a Zava, okay, for a minimum of 10 days, possibly longer if her flow didn't stop. But for a minimum of 10 days. Whereas a Nida, she stays a Nida for a minimum of 7 days. Okay? And usually it concluded at that point. Obviously, if her Hefsek Tahara didn't come out clean, it would stretch on for a little bit longer. Okay. Now, any questions here, Adasa? Or so far so good?
No, it sounds great.
Okay.
Yeah, so far so good. I think it's. I think at the stage that we're in now, it can feel a little confusing. It's like, this sounds like what we do today is sort of like a combination in some ways. We're pulling parts of both. So like, how does that work? But we'll get there. So,
no, you're exactly on target on both points. A, it sounds confusing, and B, what we do today really is a conglomeration of pulling parts of both, and it's really connected. Because it became so confusing, okay, eventually change was made, but we will talk about that at greater length in a later episode. But the fact that you're feeling confused and yet you're recognizing certain aspects means that that we're doing good. Okay, so now I've referenced a number of times the notion that she becomes a Zava if she bleeds when it's not her state of Nida. And here's where it really gets fun. It's slash confusing, i.e. how did she know when she was a Nida and how did she know when she was a Zava if it was bleeding from the womb, okay? It was, so to speak, the same symptoms and yet the results were very different, okay? So from the moment a woman or even a young girl, you know, bled for the first time, she marked her calendar, okay? So she marked her calendar and she knew that from the moment she bled, the following 7 days, she was now in a state of Nida, okay? And then the Gemara teaches us, and the various commentaries teach us, and they of course learn this from the various understandings of the Psukim that I've referenced, that following the 7 days of Nida, a woman was in an 11-day window, so to speak. And in that 11-day window, so let's plug this into a calendar, okay? It's the first of the month of Kislev, right? So, and I get my period. So I have Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zion. For the first 7 days of the month of Kislev, I am Anida. For the 11 days following that, right? So until the 18th, because it's going to be 7 and 11. So until the 18th of Kislev, in that 11-day window, if I were to see bleeding, if I were to see bleeding, then if it was 1 or 2 days, I would be a Zava Ketana and I would immerse in the mikvah following the following 1 clean day, okay? And if it would continue and there would be 3 consecutive days of bleeding, then I would become a Zava Gdaila and I would have to have 7 clean days, right? But, and again, I want to emphasize this, only if it was in that 11-day window. So what would happen now is we have two differences of opinions. Now, primarily, the two differences of opinions are associated with Rashi and the Rambam. And I'm not going to go into great elaboration of either of them because that would be just too much fun. And I don't know how much we're allowed, how much fun we're allowed on a podcast. But we're just going to try to give a very quick summary of both of them, okay? So
the people who enjoy this kind of stuff, the math geeks, can reach out to Rifki privately.
Yeah.
We'll get into it. Or take our NIDA course and you can
exactly
learn it on your own.
Exactly. I was just going to plug for your NIDA course. Exactly. So the more popular opinion is the opinion of Rashi, okay? And let's talk about Rashi's opinion for a moment over here. So there was Rosh Chodesh Kislev for 7 days. She's a NIDA. The 11-day window following that, if she were to see bleeding, she would become either a Zavak Tana or a Zavak Daila and would be required to have 7 clean days, okay? And then Rashi says as follows. The next time she would see bleeding, doesn't matter when it was. It could be 2 weeks later, it could be a month later, regardless. The next time she would see bleeding, she would again start her 7-day followed by the 11-day window, okay? So in other words, the woman's cycle, so to speak, determined her calendar. But she had to keep that calendar. So she marked on her calendar when her 7 days were, followed by 11-day window. If the 11-day window passed uneventfully, you know, then the next time she bled, again, she would have her 7 days of Nida, followed by the potential 11-day window. Now, I want to add, and this is an important detail, because despite how much halachic discussion there is on the Zava, it wasn't actually very common, okay? Which is a good thing, because like I said, the Zava meant that she was exposed to a higher level of impurity, i.e. requiring a more intense process of purity. And so it's good to know that the women weren't generally exposed to that, okay? So now that's that of Rashi. The Rambam has a little bit of a different take, which is actually kind of interesting considering that the Rambam was a physician. And the Rambam's take is that the calendar is determined by the calendar. What do I mean by that? From the very moment that a woman were to get her period, okay, so again, Rosh Chodesh Kislev, she would mark 7 days, followed by an 11-day window, immediately followed again, 7-11, 7-11. Over and over again, with very few exceptions, 7-11, 7-11. Which meant that regardless of what was actually happening on the ground, so to speak, right? When a woman bled, she had to reference her calendar and say, what window am I in? Am I in the 7 or am I in the 11? And accordingly, she then applied the rules of the Nida or the rules of the Zava, right? So whereas in the first opinion, the opinion of Rashi, it kind of aligns more with what I had said earlier, that the Nida was the menstrual cycle, and the 11-day window following that would be more of an aberration, like a breakthrough bleeding. And then the next time she bled, whenever that would be, which would be her menstrual cycle again, she would once again start her 7 and 11. With the Rambam, it becomes far more confusing, because with the Rambam, she could be experiencing what biologically, so to speak, would actually be her menstrual cycle, but it would be during her 11-day window, right? Now, if this sounds confusing, it was. So now what's interesting to note is that both the Rambam and Rashi, you know, they have these differences of opinions. Now, when I say Rashi and Rambam, it's properly associated with them, but obviously there are other opinions that agree or disagree with them. But what's important to note is that even amongst our greatest Torah scholars, there's disagreement to exactly how the women actually kept their calendar, which gives us insight to that it wasn't something simple, right? And I emphasize that because that's going to help us understand why we move away from the Nida d'Oraita that I have described up until now to the way we keep the laws today, right? Because remember, today, I mean, back in the day when they were keeping their calendar, there's even a question to how exactly did they keep their calendar, right? So probably the more wealthy women maybe had parchment and feather. You know, those that didn't have access to that kind of wealth perhaps scratched it onto a stone. Or I don't know. There's no exact clear indication of how this was kept. And remember, this was kept from when a young child possibly or a young woman would get her period. So again, if you belong to a Kohanic family, I guess up until the point where you could take charge of your own calendar, your mother was keeping your calendar, you know, and as you got older, she taught it to you and she gave you your stone or your parchment or whatever it was, and she taught you how to keep it. But one could imagine, and of course, you know, let's not even forget apps. There weren't even watches. There weren't clocks. There weren't really calendars as we're so accustomed to. You know, they went by the sun. They went by the moon. And a lot of this stuff were very critical to how they kept their calendar. Remember, if you saw it on the seventh day, it was one thing. If you saw it on the within the 11-day window, it was an entirely different set of rules. And so Shkia, that would be very critical in how that played out. What's if the sun, what's if it was very overcast that day and you didn't quite see what time the sun set, etc. You didn't even know when the day ended, right? So I'm emphasizing this because it's important for us to understand, you know, the many details and how critical the details were, right? Imagine if a woman was, you know, what if she lost her calendar and she suddenly starts bleeding and she's not sure, you know, according to the Rambam, if she's in her 7-day window or if she's in her 11-day window. And what if, even according to Rashi, she lost her calendar? What is she supposed to do? So there's actually lengthy conversations that the Gemara has, or that Rashi has, really, more accurately, where he does like a wild amount of mathematical calculations. And basically, she has to take in every kind of scenario. And at a certain point, she would get back, you know, to her starting point, right? So, wow. Yeah. And again, this wasn't something that just influenced the one area of your life of intimacy. This was something that had much larger, greater, and sometimes very costly, you know, ramifications. I say costly, meaning if you were in a state of tumah and you touched all the food gifts that your father had just brought home, etc., right? And of course, we're talking about nida d'oraita. We're talking about like, you had to be very, very careful. You didn't want to, God forbid, transgress, you know, something that was liable, you know, for transgressing a d'oraita prohibition, okay? So that just hopefully gives us a little bit of a glimpse, a little bit of an understanding of what we're talking about. So just in summation, we have met in the text the Nida and the Zava. The Nida, from when she experiences it, for 7 days, she remains in her state of Nida. She does her Hefsektara. That very evening, she immerses in the mikvah. The Zava, now again, now we understand how she would know if she was a Zava. So it would be in the 11-day window following that. She experiences, in our scenario, 3 consecutive days of bleeding. She ascertains that her bleeding has stopped. She then has 7 clean days. Only at the conclusion of those 7 clean days does she then immerse in the mikvah. And at that point, she re-enters her state of tahara. Okay? I just want
to... I also want to just go back to what you were saying before about, you know, understanding, like, sort of practically how these... The laws of Nida and Zava were practiced amongst women, you know, back in the day in the times of the Beis Mikdash, because I feel like that's really going to inform what we're going to talk about in the next episode about how and why things changed. And I think just understanding that, like, whatever the Chachamim sort of, like, instituted in terms of, like, trying to, you know, change the way we practice this on a practical level was really, like, a very, just coming with a very, you know, practical understanding of what the lives of women look like, right? And I think many mitzvahs d'rabbanan are like that. You know, if you really think about, like, sort of what it was like, right, in a very real life, you know, in very real life circumstances to practice these laws before those, you know, mitzvahs d'rabbanan were put into place, you get a sense of like how, just almost how practical the Chachamim were when they instituted these things, and like how easy it was to make mistakes, and how easy it was to sort of just get confused and get lost before those sort of guidelines were put into place.
Yeah, exactly. In other words, what you're saying is that the Rabbanim were really like, their approach was very pragmatic. It was really about ensuring that the foundations, you know, these critical concepts would be kept safe. And so they instituted, and that's what we'll talk about, the changes that would provide that necessary siyag that you mentioned. Yeah, exactly. And you're right. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine, like, how did they keep a calendar, you know? Certain things that we so take for granted today didn't exist back then. And the ramifications of it were very, very large and wide.
I do want to end off here by clarifying that this episode is not at all relevant to our practical observance of Hilchos Nida today. And when we talk about Nida d'Oraisa, we are not talking about another standard of keeping Hilchos Nida, but we're talking about the way it existed in a different time. And the way we practice Hilchos Nida today is very much impacted by the next stages of the development of the halakha, which we're going to be exploring in the following episode. So this episode is just the first half of the picture, and there's a whole other side of these halachos, which are crucial for understanding what is necessary in implementing the laws of Nida the way we are required to practice it in our day and age. Rivki, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
And yeah, we're looking forward to next episode.